Blog Talk Radio. Performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest writer, musician, Danny Bland. How are you, Danny? Danny? Okay, it seems like we've lost Danny. You there, Danny?
Hello. I hear you.
Okay, good. Yay. All right. For over 25 years, Danny Bland has been a musician with Dwarves, Catbutt, Best Kissers in the World, and also a road manager for the Super Suckers, the Gutter Twins, the Knitters, and currently Dave Alvin. He's also a writer, and a mighty fine one at that. His debut novel, In Case We Die, will be released by Fantagraphics Books in September. Danny, can you start out by telling the listeners a little about your book?
It's kind of a period piece. You know, it takes place in early 90s Seattle, and really it is a sort of a drug and alcohol soaked love story when you get right down to it.
Now you're definitely, your novel is definitely not one that seems like it was created within the confines of an MFA program. It's dirtier, it's more born of the streets and heavy duty experience. But it's obvious.
I don't even know what those letters mean that you said. So yeah, you're probably right.
But it's obvious you've got writing chops. I mean, there are shades of poetry, shades of William Volman, Jerry Stahl, Dennis Johnson, Chuck Palahniuk. How did you go about developing your writing voice?
It just sort of something that naturally happened. I mean, I'm definitely a fan of Jerry Stahl's and Harry Cruz, and it's sort of an organic thing. I just sat down and I write a bunch of haikus and so I guess some poetry could have snuck in there.
Yeah,
and I'm influenced by a lot of lyricists like X Chong and Xene, very poetic sort of dark and so I took all the elements that I'm a fan of, and sort of that's what came out of me.
Absolutely. How much of your own life would you say is interwoven with the story of Charlie Hyatt, who's our main character?
You write what you know. So, essentially, I did all of this. Charlie is a junkie. Charlie works at a porno shop at the graveyard shift. Charlie eventually ends up working at a treatment center. All of which I have done. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel that being a musician has given you any particular advantages when writing fiction? Or disadvantages,
No, I mean, you have the advantage of experience and those of a musician, especially a touring musician. You get to see other cities. You get to see the world if you're lucky, and you get to meet an insane cast of characters, and you get to see a lot of facets of life that I wouldn't have been able to see if I was, selling air conditioning units in Phoenix or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and what I said earlier, that your novel, was one born of the streets and you know, heavy-duty real-life experience. I definitely saw those elements coming out, you know, and realizing as I was reading that, you know, wow, being a musician, I'm sure, really helped to inform your voice. So, yeah, you know, speaking of which, over the years, you've been in quite a few notable bands, The Dwarves, Best Kissers in the World, Cat Butt. Speaking of Cat Butt, you know, I love this humorous and slightly sardonic description of the band in your book. You say that the first shot of whiskey was still burning in my throat when Cat Butt hit the stage. They looked like a gang of bikers had fucked a bunch of Dr. Seuss characters and forced their children to form a rock and roll band. They sounded like the MC5 had never learned to tune their instruments. Well done. I just love that. And then I really, you know, just couldn't help but chuckle when I saw you reference Cat Butt like that, you know, especially since you were in the band. I want to play a Cat Butt track in a little while, Born Loser. But before doing so, I want to talk a little about the novel setting. As you mentioned earlier, the story takes place in Seattle during the 90s. It was obviously a tremendously explosive and influential time in the city, definitely part of the cultural zeitgeist, mostly in relation to its music scene. You know, you being a musician who was deeply ensconced in the scene at that time, what was going on in your life, and how did all this spotlight on the scene affect you and your friends?
Well, you know, I mean, it was to think back on it and try to imagine what we were, you know, what was going on in our minds is kind of funny, because I don't really recall taking the time to examine anything back then. You know, it was just get up and go all the time. Usually it was, for me, you know, it was get up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and plow forward and see what the day had to offer. But, you know, I moved to Seattle from Phoenix. And to me, you know, once we got to Seattle, there was so much more opportunity for places to play and musicians and drugs and everything. It was more of a playground for me. So I got up every morning and tried to devour as much as possible.
Yeah. What were some of the bands you appreciated most during that period? Which were the ones that seemed like the real deal?
Oh, you know, I was a big fan of Mudhoney, and the Dwarves came along a little bit later on, but they were favorite. And, of course, I loved the Super Suckers, were friends of mine who moved up from Arizona as well. And like I liked Swallow quite a bit. That's one of the bands that you don't really hear much about. And you know, Nirvana, of course, and these are all groups that I ended up working with in some capacity or another when I worked at Sub Pop for a little while as well.
You know, the media, you know, when the whole scene was blowing up and the media was sort of interpreting the scene in different ways, you being on the inside, what did the scene represent to you? Do you feel like there was like a sort of a unified, defined message trying to come out of the city, or?
Yeah. Well, I remember definitely feeling part of a sort of a ne'er-do-well type community. Like, I remember feeling a part of something, but I don't know that we were, you know, that it was as organized as to present a message to the rest of the world. We were just sort of doing what came naturally, feeding off of each other. And I think that's what formed, you know, whatever would become known as grunge or this particular scene, just feeding off of other musicians, you know.
Right.
And not really looking towards major labels or any kind of stardom or anything like that. That was you know, that was for other people and other kinds of music. So really we were just playing music, doing, you know, and hoping to put out our own material. Or,
yeah,
you know, the best, at the time, you know, the best one could do was get on Sub Pop.
So, yeah, and it was a damn good label. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because the novel, you know, it does have drugs are very much a big part of what Charlie's dealing with throughout the novel, and the people around him sort of, you know, looking at drugs for a moment, as far as the Seattle scene goes, you know, because we've, you know, there have been some notable musicians, especially within the Seattle scene that have had drug-related deaths. I'm curious, do you think drugs became a bigger part of the Seattle scene to perhaps help certain musicians cope with everything that was going on during that time?
You know, I mean, initially, it's like with everybody else. You know, initially you do drugs because it feels good and you want to get high. And then, of course, it turns on you later on. But, you know, there is, you know, as far as musicians, Cobain, for instance, like he was surrounded by yes men and people who wanted to keep him, you know, keep him happy. I don't think we were really sort of, we weren't really that familiar with tough love or those forms. You know, I mean, the first time that I went to a treatment center, I didn't know anyone who had ever been to a treatment center before. So I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what was going to come, what was going on. So we were, you know, it was a different time, and we knew less about how to handle those situations. You know, we, you know, of course we knew that drugs were no good and that people were going to die, but we never imagined, or I personally never imagined in a million years it would happen to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't we go ahead and play our first musical track? We were talking about Cat Butt earlier, and here's a track called Born Loser.
Yeah.
And that was Cat Butt, Born Loser. And if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with author, musician, Danny Bland, and we're talking about his upcoming debut novel, In Case We Die, on Fantagraphic Books. Danny, we were talking about the Seattle music scene back in the 90s a little while ago. I wanted to sort of just get back to that for a couple more questions.
I think you can tell from listening to that last track that calling me a musician is a grandiose overstatement.
I got to tell you, man, I you know, all the tracks you sent me, Cat Butt, The Dwarves, Best Kissers in the World, I really have been enjoying all of them. So so thank you for that. And I do consider you a wonderful musician and a wonderful writer for that matter. Well, speaking of music, you know, I'm curious, once, you know, grunge music kind of, you know, the record industry was swooping in, the media, and in a way turning grunge music into a commercial commodity. I'm curious, what was your relationship to the music before this happened, and then sort of during the time period, and then after all this happened? Did your feelings about music change in any way?
You know, not really. The music that I loved, you know, beforehand was, and some of it was rooted in the Northwest. Like, I was a big Sonics fan, so, and a big garage rock fan, and that was really sort of the place where the music that I was fond of, you know, but I supported and went out to see all the bands that played around town, all of our friends, I had some favorites, some not so, and the fact that they were selling records didn't really change that.
Right. You know, earlier you mentioned, when I was talking about your book and how it had shades of poetry, and you were talking about writing haikus and different things, you know, I'm curious, how did you go about making the transition from musician to novelist? Because novel writing is obviously a very specific type of writing. You're telling a story, you've got to build it in a certain way, you've got to develop characters. Was this at all a difficult process for you?
Well, you know, it was something that I wanted to do for a long, long time, and I was able to, procrastinate for decades, essentially. You know, I mean, when I worked at the Champ Arcade, which is the porno shop where the beginning of the book takes place, I remember thinking at the time that some of these things would be great stories to be in a book one day, and I even took notes back then, but, you know, real life catches up to you, and you got to work, and you got to make a living, and you got to figure out who you are, and in my case, you have to, you know, recover from being a drug addict and learn who you are all over again. So, it's sort of the idea and the meat of the novel sort of was in my brain for a long time. So, but one, you know. And then at a certain point, I just realized that, and especially being on tour, being a tour manager or a musician, the time that you spend away from home, the time that you spend in the van or the bus, is you sort of are in this this weird adolescent state. And then all of a sudden you get home, and then you realize, like, holy shit, you know, 10 years has just passed, or maybe even more. But and just one day I just sat down and said, I have to write every single day or I'm never going to write. Yeah. And that's what I started to do.
Well done. How did the novel end up with Fantagraphic?
Well, Fantagraphics was actually the first place I ever thought of for it to come out, and I tried not to, like, I know myself well enough while I was writing, and again, it's like I'd write every single day, and something, whether it was a sentence or a note or even 1,000 words, I'd have to do something every day, And I knew while I was doing that, until I completed the book, I didn't want to think about marketing it. I didn't want to think about where it would go or how it would come out. I just knew I needed to finish it first. And but when I got done with it, the first thing I thought of was Fantagraphics, because it's such a Seattle-centric book. And they're a Seattle publishing company. And I'm a fan of the way their books look. And, you know, most of them are graphic novels. That's what they're really, you know, known for. But, and so I sort of, my manager's a woman named Rachel Flotard, who's also a Seattle musician. And we just, you know, put together a plan and we attacked them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, did the novel go through many changes before it went to print?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I had, over the course of the 2 years or 2.5 years I was writing, I had several different people helping me edit it, but really not many changes, not by the time it was done.
Right. Why don't we go ahead and play another musical track. This was another band that you played with, the Dwarves,
yeah.
And this is called Everybody's Girl. That was the Dwarves with Everybody's Girl, and we are talking with Danny Bland. I am talking with Danny Bland, author, musician. We're talking about his debut upcoming novel, In Case We Die, on Fantagraphics Books. Danny, there's a point in the novel where Charlie Hyatt says, "I was at home in this ugliness. I was comfortable with being wrong." How much of that do you feel could be said about your own life?
I would say that would be that should be put on my tombstone. Actually, you know, and that was something that it's still something that I feel sort of. That's still something I feel today. Really, you know, it doesn't involve the same kind of wrong, but it's a, you know, it's something that we feel, I'm going to throw you in the same category as me for a little while here.
Sure.
You know, apart from regular society, apart from quote unquote normal people or civilians, as I call them. And we just feel better. And you know, feel better in the dregs and the darkness.
Yeah, yeah. How was it for you to, speaking of darkness, how was it to dredge up all your past experiences, drug related experiences, and everything when writing the book?
You know, it's one of those things that you don't really, you know, I don't really have. That sort of hysterical amnesia about the things that I did. I remember them. I remember, if I don't remember the events themselves quite clearly, I remember the feelings that go around them, and I don't want to forget them because I don't want to return to that place. So,
sure.
But it was, you know, junkies like people who fight in wars have sort of a unique experience that, normal people don't have. So I wanted to access those feelings or those and try to explain them to civilians.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the thing that finally made you get sober?
I wish that it was something sort of heroic, but really what it was is I sort of just ran out of resources, you know. I think this happens to a lot of people. It's like I ran out of money. I ran out of options. I ran out of a place to live. I ran out of friends to steal from. And then, luckily enough, at the same time, and this is sort of pre me having any knowledge about intervention, but really just the band that I was playing at the time, which was the Best Kissers in the World, they just decided to have a meeting with me and told me that they were sending me off to treatment. And that was it for me. So, and luckily it happened at a time when I had nothing. I had no options and no way to get out of it. And that meant an opportunity for me. Because if I could have figured out a way to wrangle out of it, weasel out of it, I certainly would have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of best kissers in the world and the guys that help you get clean, we have a Best Kissers in the World track to play, Vicodin. Why don't we go ahead and cue that up?
Yeah.
That was Best Kissers in the World with Vicodin, and I'm talking to Danny Bland, musician and author of the upcoming debut novel, In Case We Die, on Fantagraphics Books. Danny, I love the whole audiobook aspect of the novel, and I also love how a portion of the proceeds are going to Music Cares, the nonprofit arm of the Grammy Foundation, which provides medical assistance, and sobriety resources for musicians. You know, on the audiobook, you've got quite the cavalcade of musicians, actors, and performers reading. You've got one of my favorites, Dave Alvin. You've got Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses, Wayne Kramer, the MC5, another one of my faves, John Doe from X and the Knitters, Dana Gould, the comedian, Mike McCready from Pearl Jam. I mean, the list goes on and on. How did that come together?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, I was just trying to, after I got done with the book, and I was thinking of, my mind went to marketing and how do I sort of, you know, how do I make this book more interesting to press people or anybody, or how do I grab a couple of headlines or whatever. You know, everyone seems to be making audiobooks, and I knew that an audiobook by a debut author, you know, you wouldn't be horribly interested in hearing me read it, but I have access and a bunch of friends from being a tour manager over the years. So I called in the usual suspects, called in my friends and asked them, and asked them to help out.
And was there any particular process about choosing who would read? Because I notice you've got, you know, John Doe reading one certain chapter, Wayne Kramer reading another. I mean, did you kind of envision it, who you wanted to read what chapter, or how did that come about?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, there were definitely, I picked some chapters for certain people to do, and you know, John Doe's in particular is because, you know, the first part of it is, you know, the first chapter, I liked the idea of Dave Alvin's voice because he's got that great narrator tone, and it's setting the scene for the rest of the novel. And, you know, the second chapter is fully filthy and sexual and deviant, and so of course, you know, Greg Dooley's voice is best equipped for that. and on and on, you know, John Doe in particular, because John Doe's chapters were where we sort of are introduced to the main female character of the book, who is the love interest, who is sort of the
Carrie.
First time you see some humanity in Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of figure out why he is the way he is. And, you know, ladies love John Doe, and it's got a little bit of singing in it. So I brought John Doe in on that one.
Nice. Well, speaking of the audiobook, we were able to pull one section from Chapter 20, Reverberation Doubt, where you've got Mark Boone Jr., one of my favorite actors, reading. And why don't we go ahead and listen to a little of that?
Chapter 20, Reverberation, Doubt. Your tits look spectacular in that dress. The dress in question was a low-cut, yellow polka-dotted summer number. She also wore a large straw hat, dark Ray-Bans, and a black bra, whose straps she now pulled up, creating all the more reason for me to focus on that dress. "That's kind of the idea, isn't it?" she asked, sliding her sunglasses to the tip of her nose. "I mean, seriously, you could do Shakespeare off a balcony like that." "Shut the fuck up." She bent down to check her teeth for lipstick in the side mirror. "Wish me luck," she said, lightly pecking me on the lips. I watched as she walked down the block, not knowing if she was exaggerating the swing in her ass for my benefit or if she was just warming up for what awaited inside. It was a sunny day, an integral component of our strategy, and the light shining through her dress was as wonderful to behold as she no doubt figured it would be. People, especially in Seattle, were much more easily distracted on a pleasant day. The sunshine in that yellow dress would leave anyone, male or female, hard-pressed to describe her face after the fact. Kelly Thompson was born into violence, baptized in crashing lamps and broken dishes. The parade of men who moved in with her mother were not so much stepfathers as they were adversaries. Kelly could negotiate the living room in the midst of full-blown domestic war without spilling a drop of milk or dropping a single Oreo cookie. She'd sit herself down a couple of feet in front of the television, turn it up loud enough to drown out the yelling, and become invisible. Chaos was her comfort zone, bedlam and disorder her playground. She would size up each new man her mom moved in and see the day she would be used as a human shield as they escaped with a couple of suitcases and her cat. She taught her babysitters how to smoke. She learned the joys of NyQuil and cherry-flavored codeine cough syrup at an early age. She was the most prolific preteen shoplifter Eastern Washington had ever seen. She was, in a word, ambitious.
That was the actor Mark Boone Jr. reading a portion of Chapter 20, Reverberation Doubt, from Danny Bland's upcoming debut novel, In Case We Die. Danny, you know, you've gained, you know, quite a bit of notoriety as a musician. You're a tour manager to the stars, and now you're a published novelist with a badass debut novel under your belt. How does that feel?
It feels pretty good. Yeah, I hope I can squeeze everything into my schedule, you know.
Yeah, you know, I want to have you read for, you know, that would be, you know, the fair thing and the right thing to do. Have you read a little bit of your own novel before doing so? I have one or two other questions I want to ask. The photos, some really beautiful photos, provocative photos throughout the book. Did you take those or?
No, those were taken by Lance Mercer, who is pretty well-known or very well-known photographer here in Seattle and you know, might be Pearl Jam's official photographer. I'm not sure. But he has, you've seen his work before. Definitely. He's been around forever and done many of the, album covers and photos for bands that you've seen in the past. And he's amazing. He's got a great eye and I just asked him to, you know, look at the book, and then we got together and did some pictures that had the feel of what was going on. I didn't want to have, you know, obviously it's not a historical document, so didn't have pictures of the actual people, and I wouldn't want to put, you know, I wouldn't want to direct anyone's imagination into looking any different than it does in their mind. So
sure.
We just did, you know, sort of sparse black and white shots that had the feel of the book in it.
Yeah, they're really quite wonderful. I want to quote Charlie Hyatt again from the book. He says this: "First thing, buddy, you and I are going to be of service. One of the things you'll learn around here, Justin, is that the best way to get out of your own fucked up head is to help out, to help another person out." And I'll ask you, Danny, what's an example or two throughout your own life, be it through music, your writing, or just living, that you've been able to be of service to others?
Well, you know, mostly, I'm on tour a lot, so but I get phone calls because I've been sober for a long time, you know, 21 years. A lot of times I'll get phone calls from girlfriends and wives and mothers of guys who are fucked up, who are having troubles, who are sleeping in parks and deep into drugs. And what I do is sort of, you know, direct them to treatment, or you know, I can talk to people like that without sort of coming on as a religious fanatic, or, you know, I can talk to someone who is in that position, because I've been in that position, and that's really the best, that's the way that I am of service, and usually I end up directing them to treatment, and if they're a musician, then I hook them up with Music Care so they can have the resources to get into treatment for free, or at least they can get helped out. And that's another reason why we're using a portion of the profits from the audiobook to go to Music Cares, because it's a service that I've used countless times to get countless guys into and ladies into treatment. So that's sort of my MO.
Great. Well, that's definitely being of service. Why don't we go ahead and have you read a little from your own novel?
Shall we start now?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to start from the beginning.
Great.
So, chapter one, Slip Inside This House. Had you not spent five nights a week there, had you not spent five nights a week in there like I had, upon entering the Champ Arcade, your senses may have been overwhelmed by the purient cacophony of it all. Tits and asses, cocks and snatches, eyes come hither, eyes roll back, blinking lights everywhere, beckoning you to phallic monstrosities too gruesome to imagine handling, much less inserting, directing you to unguents and salves, lotions and greases, assaulting your higher mind to abandon ship, believe and trust your dirty little lizard brain to call the shots. You might have tried to subdue this onslaught by limiting your gaze to the glass enclosures immediately to your left. Here, coach whips, blindfolds, handcuffs, articles of confusion when discovered in a well-hidden box in your mother's closet, were nostalgic, romantic even. But this was no place for sweetness. A closer inspection would reveal so many other trinkets and tchotchkes that you'd be overwhelmed all over again. Single-server packets of lube, canisters of amyl nitrate, Spanish fly, bench ticklers, cock rings, enema kits, latex gloves, medical face masks, ball gags, dental gags, paddles, rectal thermometers, forceps, nose clamps, an assortment of stainless steel spectrums, and a box of X-Acto blades, utensils for the truly depraved. You might have sought shelter in the uniform predictability of more than 10,000 VHS tapes on racks, their covers of deep reds and soft focus promising blonde Scandinavian maidens, erotic courtesans of the Orient, black chicks. Maybe you were like me. Maybe you'd never forgotten your hairier, greasier first loves. The Devil and Miss Jones, Talk Dirty to Me, Taboo Too, and found some perverse feeling of home just looking at these boxes. There you go.
Well done. That was Danny Bland reading from his upcoming debut novel, In Case We Die. Danny, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you one last question. With all your life experiences, musical experiences, the writing of this book, what insights would you say you've gained regarding life and death?
Well, the... life and death. Well, you know, the thing that I figured out most recently and the most prolific thing to me was time, and how if you have someone extremely close to you, a relative, a loved one, friend, die, especially suddenly, time changes for you, and you realize that it's a limited resource, and that you need to, or I needed to, start doing the things that I planned on doing. And that's really sort of the whole reason why this book exists, because I realized that time was not necessarily going to be my friend and I needed to get it done right away. So I don't know if that's what you're asking about or not.
No, that's exactly it. And very well put, very well put. So what's coming up for you next, Danny, and what's the best way for people to find out what you're up to?
Well, you know, the book comes out September 2nd, I believe. And, you know, you can pre-order it. If you pre-order the book through Fantagraphics, you get a free download of the audiobook. The audiobook comes out at the same time. There's downloadable versions, and there's a physical version as well. And I'll be reading at Bumper Shoot here in Seattle. And I'll be down at Powell's Bookstore on September 9th. And I'll be at Book People in San Francisco on September 11th. And Book Soup in Los Angeles on the 14th. And Wayne Kramer and Dave Alvin come out and read with me.
And I'm so bummed about missing that show, because that weekend I'm going to be up in San Francisco performing. And when I saw that on your your tour schedule, I was like, no! Oh, man. But I wish you the best of luck with all that. How about online? Can people find out more about you online anywhere?
Yeah, if you go to incasewedie.com or dannybland.com, or you can find me on Facebook or Twitter, all that stuff, Instagram.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Danny.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julie at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. And a big thanks to Wee Boy Sing. They provide the theme music for Poet Escape. You can find Wee Boy Sing online at weeboysing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at weeboysing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be dance choreographer and writer, LA's own Rosanna Gampson. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poet Escape.
Thanks, Rich.